occasionally we can find people who will claim that the Bible is boring, an old boring book. Young people especially tend to think that. And I suppose there are some passages that really qualify for being boring, but today's readings, no. Today we have the very dramatic story of the destruction of Sodom from the book of Genesis, and then in the gospel, story of a violent storm that comes up suddenly on the Sea of Galilee. So these are dramatic events. These are big, great movie scenes. I know some people don't like disaster movies. They're kind of predictable. But with disaster movies, usually what they do is the producers or the writers, they pick out some dramatic, terrible catastrophe, and then that's the big picture. And then they show the experience of individual people or families or, you know, lovers or somebody who's affected by the catastrophe and how they escape from it at the last minute. So it's always a story about disaster, but it's also a story about somebody who makes it. Otherwise, the movie's too discouraging. Maybe most of the people die, but somebody always comes out alive. Well, that's the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, isn't it? I mean, everybody gets wiped out except Lot and his two daughters. Now, when it comes to reflecting on disasters or any kind of negative event, again, you'll hear people say, people who will put all the blame on God for being a bad God or being cruel. So if something bad happens, well, it's God's fault. And then in the case of the gospel, if God doesn't do anything, well, then it's his fault. So in the first reading, God is the actor. He's destroying the city. And in the gospel, he's asleep. Jesus is asleep in the boat. So you see how there's a certain tendency in human nature to interpret everything negatively, as if no matter what happens, either something happens or something doesn't happen, well, God isn't good. Now, I'm exaggerating this to make a point. Obviously, there are also tendencies in human nature to look at the bright side of everything. Every morning is a beautiful morning. Every night there's a beautiful sky and all this sort of thing. I mean, yes, that's true too. But I want to just focus on these negative reactions because this will help us ponder these readings. Let's focus especially on the story of the destruction of Sodom. This is the biblical classic story about the punishment of evildoers. Wicked city has to be destroyed, and God is going to wipe it out. And because it's a classic story, people have ideas about what it really means. And usually people's idea is this is the violent God of the Old Testament with his wrath destroying the bad guys. If you read the story more closely, you realize God did not want to destroy the cities. He didn't want to. And he didn't want to harm anyone who was innocent. Now, we skipped over that passage because yesterday was a feast day of St. Thomas, and we didn't read about the conversation between Abraham and God and about how many innocent people there would have to be in order to save the city. And God keeps giving in, even if there's only 50, even if there's only 40, even if there's only 30. In other words, if there's just a few innocent people, I'll spare the whole city. That's what I want to do. It's as if the passage shows that the destruction of the city is a last resort. There's no choice. And that can be puzzling to us. You say, well, how can that be? There's no choice. I mean, God is God. He can do what he wants. But God is just. And it's a good thing that he is just, because if there's no justice, then nothing matters. If there's no consequences for wrongdoing, then it doesn't matter what we do. And that would be a horrible horrible reality to face. Our difficulty is how to balance justice with mercy, how to take into account the seriousness of human misbehavior, and at the same time recognize that when someone is repentant, there can be mitigation of the punishment. And we know that God, who is a just God, is also extraordinarily merciful God, and he balances these things out in a way that's mind-boggling to us. But it's important to keep the principle of justice. Let me just share a little example of a modern example. Maybe this man is not well known in the Philippines, but in the United States, he's a very well-known former cardinal, Cardinal McCarrick. Now he's no longer cardinal. In fact, he's no longer even a priest. He's been laicized. So Cardinal McCarrick was a very, very powerful, influential cardinal in the United States. He had influence also in the Vatican. But it came out after years that he had a number, at least many accusations against him for abuse of young men. The kind of sin that is associated with the city of Sodom. That's why he comes to mind. Now, he was investigated by the church. The church found him guilty. In the church's own legal system, found him guilty, deprived him of his cardinal position, and then suspended him, and then finally kicked him out of the priesthood. So very, very severe penalties, and he's left with no privileges and no titles or anything. But there's still a civil case against him. I mean, he's a criminal, or at least he's accused of being a criminal, but he's also an old man now. I don't know how old, maybe pushing 90, and his mind is failing. So the civil court is trying to figure out what to do with this man. How can we put him on trial if he's too weak or if his mind is failing? How can we investigate his crimes in a just way? Just last week, there was a report that he was found to be incapable of standing trial. Either he's too weak or his dementia has advanced too far or whatever. And so they said it's not possible to put him on trial. So then there's this debate, what to do with this man. On the side of mercy, people say, well, he's an old man. What are you going to do? Put him in jail? I mean, he can't walk, can't care for himself. Why don't you just, leave him in the nursing home or something and, be merciful? But that's a legitimate response to a crippled old man. But there's also, on the side of justice, here's a man who has done some very serious crimes, and he has not, at least as far as I know, repented. He hasn't said he's sorry. He hasn't even admitted to it. So to not have consequences is to leave the man in his sin, as if it didn't matter what he did. And that would be very bad, not only for him, also for his victims, and for the society, to say, it doesn't matter if you abuse 30 or 40 young men because you're a powerful cardinal. Doesn't matter. Well, that would be a horrible message to the victims. It would be a horrible message to society. People do whatever they want, and it's a horrible message to the man himself, because no warning that he's in danger, moral danger. Okay, now I just throw out that example because it's in the news. But people say, well, why is God so mean to the city of Sodom? Can't he let people be who they are? Let people live? Well, yeah, except then you can allow people to continue in their very serious crimes. You can continue to allow an endless series of innocent victims, and you don't do anything about it. Remember, when the angels in this story arrived in Sodom, and Lot took them into his home as visitors, the citizens of Sodom were demanding to Lot to let those men out so that they could have sexual relations with them. They wanted to rape them. And then when Lot said, no, they threaten to rape Lot too. That's their mindset. Is that nothing? Just going to let them go and no need to destroy them? Well, no. You have to show that there's serious consequences to serious sins. And that's what this story is really about. If there's any sign of repentance, if there's anything God can do to save them, he'll save them. But if they're going to stand there and attack the very ones whom he has sent to save them, what can he do? This reminds me of, talk about modern news, of the people living in the danger zones in volcanoes. This is going on right now, you know, in Mount Mayon. Mount Mayon is erupting. At least it's there's unrest and there's lava and, you know, there's rocks and stuff flying out of the crater. So the legal authorities around the danger zone are evacuating the residents. And the residents don't want to go. You can't blame them. I mean, their homes are there, their livestock, their farms, their schools. I mean, their life is there. They don't want to get up and live in an evacuation center. Nobody wants to do that. But if your life is at stake, if your life is threatened, well, better to leave. Now, this again, it's like this story of Lot. These two angels sent by God to rescue anyone who's willing to leave the city. Even Lot himself doesn't want to go. It says here, when he hesitated. So here's the message. Take your wife, your two daughters who are here, and or you will be swept away in the punishment of Sodom. That's a very clear warning. Lot hesitated. Maybe he thought he could get away with it. Maybe it wasn't that serious. Who knows? Maybe he's afraid. Maybe he's just frozen. The men, that men meaning the angels, by the Lord's mercy seized his hand and the hands of his wife and his two daughters. So there's four people and there's two angels. You see these two angels, they each grab one person and they practically drag them out of the city. That's how intent God is on saving them. It's as close as you can get to forcing them without violating their freedom. Now, God doesn't force us to be saved. But he really does want to save us, and he'll do everything he can to save us. He is not intent on killing us, destroying us, condemning us. He's not. And this is very clear from the New Testament. God did not send his Son into the world to condemn the world, but so that the world might be saved. But if people don't want to be saved, then they get condemned. What can God do about that? He doesn't force people to be saved. He doesn't force people to be condemned. The choice, the consequences of our choices are on us. Okay, so I'm just trying to pull out some lessons from this dramatic story of the destruction of Sodom. Lot is not that easy to save. He and his family are not that easy to save. But they do get saved. They get pulled out of the city. Lot doesn't. He's a minimalist. He wants to do the least effort required and still be saved. And isn't that a human tendency? I won't do any more than I absolutely have to. I'll just do enough to pass. I'll just do enough to get into heaven. I don't want to go very far. I'm not going to make a lot of effort. Even to save myself, that's a lot. Oh, no, I can't go. I can't go running into the hills. I'll just go to this little town. Please give me a break. And the Lord gives in to him. See how quick mercy is to make space for our weakness and our fears and our hesitations. And so Lot gets saved. His two daughters get saved. Lot's wife does not get saved. Why? I mean, she's being dragged out of the city by the hands of an angel. It says here, but Lot's wife looked back and she was turned into a pillar of salt. Now, I don't know literally what happened, but the spiritual lesson here is very clear. If you don't cooperate with God's extraordinary efforts to save you, well, then you won't be saved. There has to be the engagement of our free will. And if we change our minds and turn away from God, turn away from salvation, there are consequences. It's this very clear message. Okay, now let's just take a, I don't want to go on forever, but part of my point here is that, let's say, the Bible isn't boring. The book of Genesis in particular is a fascinating and profound work of literature, even a work of psychology. It's just an extraordinary book to ponder. But at least we get the message here. God wants to save us. He'll save anyone he can, as many people as he can. As it turns out, he only gets three people out of the whole city of Sodom. Now let's turn to just briefly to this storm on the lake in the gospel. We won't go into the whole drama here, but notice the presence of Jesus in the storm, the presence of Jesus in the boat. When people are in trouble and they don't see God at work and they think that he's asleep, their accusation is, "You abandoned me, God." And that's wrong. That's an error, at least, if not a judgment. It's an error to say God abandoned us, because God is right in the boat with us. Jesus is right with us in whatever we're experiencing. He may be asleep, but that doesn't mean we're abandoned. It means that his timing is not our timing, that his way of saving us is not our way of wanting to be saved. That's because God knows things we don't know. But you cannot say God is not with us, God has abandoned us, because he's always with us. He's right here in the boat. Now, if Jesus were not in the boat, if he were asleep on the other side of the mountain, then you could accuse him of not being with his disciples. But the point of this story is, in the middle of the crisis, when they feel like they're perishing, Jesus is right there with them. And when they call out to him, he responds. When they open their heart to him in their need, he is with them. Very often, God allows us to experience difficulties to move us to cry out to him so that we discover that he's with us. This is what happens in every big disaster or war or hardship. People flock back to church. People start praying again when they're in trouble. And maybe they forget about God when everything is going fine, but when something goes wrong, people wake up and say, "Lord, save me." And that's the right response. But why does God have to keep waking us up? So that we will wake him up? No, we have to be reawakened to the presence of God with us all the time. Anyway, that's enough. Great lessons from these dramatic stories. In our lives, let us recall the presence of God with us, the mercy of God, the justice of God, the victory of God over evil, and his absolute determination to save us.